You are listening to Teen Connectivity, a podcast for parents navigating the wilderness of adolescence. You are not alone. It is harder than ever to be a teen and to be the parent of a teen. These conversations are offered to deepen your understanding of the realities of being a teen in the digital age, to give you a few more tools for your parenting toolkit, and to cultivate greater empathy for your teen and for yourself. Put all this together, and it is my hope that your connection with your child will be strengthened and grow, and you will find much joy on this sacred journey. This is episode 35, Teens and Alcohol, Part 1, Parenting to Reduce Risk. This is the beginning of a three-part series, and I'm going to begin each episode with a foreword before we get into the interview with Dr. Rob Teresi from Penn State University. This topic is so important, and I hope that you'll stick with me through these next three episodes. We're going to explore evidence-based parent interventions to prevent and reduce risky underage drinking. Rob's research is centered around effective parent communication, evidence-based parent communication that reduces risk. So we're going to explore some of these evidence-based interventions throughout these next three interviews. And some of it will be really intuitive to you, and some of it won't be. His research blew my mind, and it illuminated some places where my intuition for how to parent on this topic was really, really off. And after speaking with him, I am committed to doing some course correcting. And fortunately, Dr. Teresi says it is never too late. So if you can't listen to the whole thing, just know that some of the counterintuitive part, I know that myself and many, many fellow parents have held this belief that allowing kids a glass of wine at Thanksgiving as they become teens and, you know, just sort of being a little more open about limited access to alcohol somehow demystifies it. It takes it away from being the forbidden fruit, takes away the mystery, opens the doors to honest communication with our kids, and perhaps reduces risky drinking later. The mind-blowing part is that his research says the exact opposite of this is true, that this is actually a very unsafe parenting approach. So please stick with me through the next three episodes and this really interesting conversation with Dr. Rob Teresi of Penn State University. Hello, everyone. I'm so excited to be here today with my friend, Rob Teresi. And I've always just kind of known Rob as my friend, but Rob is an expert in a subject that I think a lot of parents of adolescents will be really interested in. So I'm going to just let Rob tell you what he's an expert in. Hi, Rob. Thanks for being here.
Thank you for having me. So let me just start by sharing a little bit about what I do and why I do it. And it's not linear, and I think that's probably what most people I know do. I've been a psychologist and a professor for, I think, over 35 years now. It's closing on 40 years. And when I first started the work that I'm known for work on parent-based interventions to prevent underage students from drinking and experience the harm associated with excessive alcohol use. And when I first started doing this work, I wasn't working with teenagers and I wasn't working with parents. And actually what I was really interested in was reducing drunk driving or intoxicated or impaired driving. It has a lot of different terms for it, but really captures the same thing, which is when individuals get in their cars after they've had too much to drink and they drive. And the word too much is not subjective. There's legal limits to that. But for most people, they're probably impaired well before they reach those legal limits. But anyway, my goal was to try and reduce this from happening. I was studying behavioral decision making, and I was interested in how do people know when they've drank too much? Because we always ask people, are you okay to drive? No, when to say when, whatever the terms are. But quite honestly, I wasn't sure that people really had any idea whether they knew whether they enough to drive to whether they could drive their car or not. Like, I think if you have a glass of wine, small glass of wine at dinner, you have dinner over a course of an hour or two, you get in your car, you're probably not going to be at any level of impairment. By legal standards, it's going to put you at risk. But most people don't do that. They have multiple glasses of wine, or they have multiple drink with multiple shots of alcohol in it, and it's quite easily for them to lose track of how much they've actually consumed and how much. And so for me, I was interested in the decision making that went into this, with this idea that people really don't know if we corrected that not their errors, would they not drive as much? And I actually received a grant from the National Institute on Alcohol Abuse and Alcoholism. I'm just going to call them NIAAA because it's just a mouthful.
Okay.
To study individuals who had been arrested one time for impaired driving versus another group of individuals that had been arrested multiple times for drinking and driving versus a group of individuals who drove after they had been drinking but never been arrested versus individuals who drank but never would ever drive if they were drinking. So I really wanted to contrast the way they made their choices. And it would be no surprise to many to find out that the individuals that made the worst choice of decisions were the individuals that had been arrested multiple times. But the interesting thing was the individuals that arrested one time versus the people who have never been arrested versus the people who drink but never drive afterwards. They were very different. They were different in different ways. And it made me think, oh, and I learned so much about, most of the time, everybody knew when they drank too much. And everybody knew when they were sober or drank very little, they were okay. It was in that small, moderate range where people made the most errors. And from that, I thought, oh, well, you know, now it's time to translate that information back to these people. But they were all older. They were mostly people between the ages of 30 and 50. And in my initial attempts to do change with them, I realized there was a lot of resistance to change. Like, in other words, they're like, I'm good. I've never been arrested. I'm good. Or it only happened one time. I've been driving for a long time. I'm good. And the people who drove a lot were like, I know I got a lot of rest, but I'm good too. You know, like, everyone is good. And I was like, wow, it's really hard to change adults between 30 and 50. I think I'll go the path of least resistance and work with younger people who haven't really established these decades of drinking behavior. I'll try and change teenagers, right? At that
right.
time, I was like, this is going to be easy, changing teenagers. Wow, this is so much better than changing adults.
I'm going to make a guess that this was prior to your own kids becoming teenagers.
Exactly, right, exactly. I was not a parent at the time when I thought this would be one of the easiest things to do prevention work with people who are like 16, who, one, haven't really been driving and they haven't really been drinking. So it's possible that I could change the way they see the world before they enter the world. Like, in other words, don't make the same mistakes your parents made, right? Yes, a little naive at that time. But I did. I started working with teenagers, and at the time I had a choice. Do I work with schools where they have principals and superintendents, typically people between the age of 30 and 50, and get them to change what they do in schools, or do I work with parents? And again, at that point, path of least resistance, you know, working with principals require their approval. And most of them, they're like, oh, no, we have programs, we're good. And superintendents, no, we have programs, we're good. So really, the 30 to 50 to 60-year-old changed their ways of doing things. I was like, at that time, maybe this isn't the best idea. Instead, I'll work with youth and I'll work with their parents. So for me, even though that's where I've developed my expertise and spent decades of years working with it, it wasn't like this idea that came out of this is the right way to go. And it's maybe at the time, now looking back, it wasn't the smartest thing I could have done. But I did it, and that's where I started working. And I was having a lot of success with parents of adolescents. And at the time, I transitioned from living in Albany to Boise, and this is where we met. And the thing that kind of struck me about that was that I was a professor and I kept on having students who were in my classes that I thought were really, really super intelligent. They were doing a really good job in my classes. And I would say, what are you planning on doing with your career? And they're like, well, I don't think I'm going to go to this program or that program. And I was like, what do you mean? You're getting all A's. Why are you going? And they, at the time, would say that they repeat the common story. And the common story was, well, in my first year as an undergraduate student, I drank too much at a party or something like that. And then this is what happened. And for most of them, it was like, I didn't do well in school. I wasn't ready for the responsibility and so on. But on occasion, I would have somebody that told me a story that would stop me in my tracks. And it was usually a young woman who talked about drinking too much at a party when she was 18 years old, college freshman, and it usually involved a sexual assault. And I started thinking, well, maybe the work I'm doing with adolescents, I could do an upward adaptation and work with parents of college students. And at that time, no one was even considering trying to think about parents and college students because they were like, that won't work. You know, parents, they stop parenting once the kid reaches 18, 19. And also 18, 19-year-olds don't listen to their parents anymore anyway. You know, and so a lot of people are trying to discourage me from going down this road. But I would ask my students in class, I would say, right, little show of hands for how many of you drink, you know, on weekends. And, you know, they're 18, 19-year-olds, so lots of hands went up. And then I would say, among the ones that are 18, 19, keep your hands up if your parents know how much you're drinking. And, you know, no one would have their hand, like very few would have their hands up. So what they were saying to me was, yes, we drink a lot. And no, our parents don't know we're drinking a lot. And then I said, well, just again, quick question. How many of you would drink the same amount if your parents knew? And they were like, no, that's not going to happen. What if your parents knew and they talked to you? Just, you know, grown up to grown up. You know, you're trying to figure it out. They're trying to figure it out. You're at this age. What do you think then? And they said, well, we'd be open to that.
Okay.
And I realized right there might be an opportunity. So I went to the officials at Boise State that ran the freshman orientation. I said, can I have 30 of your parents just to talk to? And they're like, well, what do you mean, can I have 30 of your parents? I was like, well, you know, when they drop their kids off for orientation, is it okay if I just talk to them? And I said, what do you do with them now? And they said, well, we give them, and remember, not to make Boise State feel bad about this, but this is a long time ago. Parents weren't involved in any academic things. You know, they really just really dropped the kids off, and then the officials would give them a list of places they go shopping or eat downtown and then come back in a few hours after orientation's over. And so I asked to talk to 30 parents, and I randomly assigned 15 of them to my considered control condition, where they would be parents that would go shopping and eat lunch. And the other 15, I talk about, you know, how much alcohol is consumed by college students, and then the effects of them, and then the way they make their decisions, and possibly some opportunities for adult communication. And it was really crude, but it was an upward adaptation of some of the work I do with teens. And I looked at the students after they had been on campus for about 6 months, and the students in the group whose parents I talked to, they drank less.
Wow.
They got in less trouble. And it was Friday afternoon, and I just found these data, and I was so excited. I was like, this is really cool. If you talk to parents before they go to college, kids go to college, they can help their kids not have the problems that these other kids experience. And I was running up and down the halls to find someone to share the data with, but it was Friday at like 5 o'clock, and no one was around. And I think I found the person that was cleaning up the building, and I was like, let me tell you about these data. And they were looking at me, and at the end of them, they said something like, I don't speak any English. And I was like, but still, you have to agree. Shake your head if you think this is really cool. Like, yes, I'm shaking my head. It sounds cool to me. So ultimately, that's what started this approach. And then by the time the next year came around, we had a formal parent program available to students. And it was really cool that Boise State let us do this work. And then we expanded it to having a study that would, half of the work was being done in the West, and half of it was being done in the East Coast. And we found that in that trial, it involved families all over the East Coast and the West Coast. Same kind of things that when you involve parents there, and you structured the kind of conversations they were going to have, that that it was meaningful. And, you know, we tried it in high risk environments. We tried it with other combinations of intervention approaches. And by and large, what we would commonly find is that parents were interested in this, And it was not too late for them to have these conversations. And when they had these conversations, their kids benefited. And you know, you can ask me about this, but as you can see, it wasn't a linear path. It started with adults, decision-making, teenagers, and then I'm a professor, and I thought maybe this would matter here. And
so you brought up so many things already that were on my list to talk to you about. And
I stole your
question. Know, that's okay. This is good. So just so our listeners know now, you are at Penn State, correct?
That's correct.
And you have, I think I was reading, a joint appointment in sort of two different areas.
Yeah. So now, my days out west have ended. And by the way, I still love the West. So we visit it as much as possible.
And I should also say, we're in San Francisco talking, and we just both happen to be here at the same time. It's kind of awesome how things work. But your work is at Penn State now.
Yeah, well, that's where I'm a professor now, and that's where our sort of home base is, even though it's going on now all over the country and actually quite a number of places all over the world. So, yes, I'm a professor at Penn State, and half of my appointment is in biobehavioral health. It's a department that I'll explain, because when I say biobehavioral health, a lot of people go, oh, that's interesting, and then they kind of gloss over a little bit, and the Prevention Research Center. So half of my life is in biobehavioral health. Half is in the Prevention Research Center. Something that was really exciting to me that helped me with deciding to move from Boise State to Penn State was the Prevention Center and biobehavioral health. One is that it was the only prevention center I knew that was all about evidence-based work and really making an impact in the community. And a good friend of mine, Mark Greenberg, was our original director. He created this idea. He came from the University of Washington and wanted to do really cool work. And his philosophy was very Buddhist, which was, how do you make a cow happy? Give the cow a lot of grass, right? How do you make scientists happy? Give them a lot of grass.
Right.
So the bottom line really was that his idea was to bring really cool, really interesting scientists that really wanted to make a large impact on the world, and have them all be together. And that was the Prevention Center idea. And it's a little more than that, but that was sort of the basic theme. Biobehavioral health was a bit like a psychology department on steroids. And the idea was that if we think about all the things that affect us, so diabetes, cancer, heart disease, substance abuse, mental health, there's always a behavioral side, and there's also a biological side. And the nice thing about the Department of Biobehavioral Health is that we don't consider these to be that or that. It's kind of like, let's integrate these. Like, in other words, probably the best metaphor for this is a diabetic. A diabetic needs insulin, so they need to address the biological aspect of their disease all the time. But behaviorally, they need to monitor their activity levels, they monitor how much they eat, what they eat, and so on. And it's one of these things that lasts forever. It's not something that they do for 5 or 10 years and then go, oh, I'm not a diabetic anymore. And so they need a biological and a behavioral treatment to help them be healthy. And I think substance abuse is not that far from that. There's a biological aspect. We're genetically different, so we respond to different drugs in different ways, but also, we have to be able to monitor behavior. Same thing for cardiovascular health or cancer or so on. So that's what makes our department kind of unusual nationally, is that we are a department of people that think about things from biological and behavioral perspectives. Most of us come in with one of these characteristics as opposed to both. The beauty of this is our students leave our program with both. So our undergraduates get a great understanding of the biological and behavioral aspects of why we have diseases, as well as what we can do to treat them or prevent them. And our graduate students and our doctoral students become the next world leaders in this area. So they get the training in both areas. So they understand the genetic side of things. They understand the what we call the HPA axis, so the hypothalamus, pituitary, adrenal glands, and how that affects stress and health and all the things that we do. But they also learn the behavioral side of things. And so some of our students come in having a real strong bio background, but not a strong behavioral background. But by the time they leave, they get balanced out. And some come in with a strong behavioral background, but not a biological one. But when they leave, they get balanced out. So it's kind of a cool department.
It sounds like an amazing program.
So yeah, between that and then living in the Prevention Research Center, where you have all these different people with these different views on how best do we change behavior? How do we sustain that change over time? What's the best way to scale up interventions that we test in these small, you talk to 30 parents and see what happens things.
And, you know, that's why I really wanted to talk to you. And not everyone gets to be a part of this small 30, you know, parents that you talk to at the beginning of a university experience for a kid. And so what I'm hoping is to leave today with some tangible tools and perspectives that parents can use for addressing drug use and alcohol use with their kids. I know yours is mostly alcohol, but I know pot especially is a pretty big concern on a lot of university campuses right now. So how do parents begin this conversation with their kid around alcohol use when it starts to appear in peer groups and maybe right when they're on the edge of that sort of seeking and experimenting behavior? What is your best go-to that parents, how do they start this talk?
You know, I'm going to answer this question like a scientist.
Okay.
So I'm going to start by saying that it's there's simple things that can be done, but I want to add some layers to it. So some of these are going to be intuitive, and some are going to be a little counterintuitive. So some of I'm going to go through the list. What can parents do? So one of the things that parents can do is they can communicate with their children. Okay, that's one. I'm going to list them first, then go through each one. So communication will be the key point at the beginning. And it's not always what we say, but the way we say it. So communication not only has to have like a message, but it has to have a delivery that's going to be effective. And so so that's one thing, and that's intuitive in some ways. So parents realize, oh, I really do need to talk to my kids. Now, some do a better job than others naturally, and you know, the nice piece about it is, with a little bit of help, tiny little tune-up, all parents can do a really good job.
I hope you've enjoyed the beginning of this really important conversation. Join us next week as this interview with Dr. Rob Teresi continues and we really start to unpack these evidence-based communication strategies for reducing risk, as well as a really enlightening conversation about parental modeling and strategies for monitoring. I'll see you next week. You have been listening to Teen Connectivity with me, Vashti Somerville, parent coach and educator. For more information on programs that I offer or to work with me, please visit www.vsparentcoach.com.